This is Lucas Kuntz, candidate for U.S. Senate, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett, and you're listening to episode 204 of Walking the Floor. I'm a poet, and I didn't know it. Can you believe episode 204, man? This thing just keeps going. Just keeps going and going and going. Okay, today's a little break from my normal type of interview, because I'm not interviewing a country singer or Americana artist or a boxer or a surfer or anything like that that you might sort of think of when you think of this show. And I'm going to warn you, it's politics, kids. So if you're going to get angry at me and yell at me on Twitter, now's the time to just turn the episode off and delete it from your phone or whatever, because we go deep into politics. Because I am talking to Lucas Kuntz today, who's running for the Democratic. He's running in the Democratic Senate primary out in Missouri. I think that seat is freeing up. It's currently held by Roy Blunt, I think, a Republican. But anyway, he's running in the primary, and I just got turned on to him recently by our mutual friend of the show, Matt Stoller. Sent me a really good interview where Lucas was talking about the Afghanistan withdrawal, and I'll put a link up to that interview on the website. He's a smart guy, former Marine. He was in the Marines for about 13 years, deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. He went to Yale. He's a lawyer. He works with Matt Stoller at the American Economic Liberties Project, working on foreign policy issues and antitrust, and we get into all that stuff. We cover everything there is to cover, baby, about Lucas Kuntz and his candidacy. And if you like what you hear, you can go to lucaskuntz.com. You can read up on where he stands on the issues and donate money to his campaign and see how you can get involved. And if you live in Missouri, you can vote for him if you like, you know, what he's all about. And I'm not trying to influence anybody here. I'm just throwing it out there, okay? Anywho, I'll let him tell you himself. This is Lucas Kuntz on Walking the Floor. But I've been particularly interested in your candidacy because, you know, I have some Missouri roots myself.
Whoa, what are they? I didn't know that.
Yeah, my grandparents on my dad's side, my dad's parents were from Missouri and, you know, came out during the Depression. So I have no firsthand, like I never lived in Missouri, and really ever went back and visited like one time when I was a kid that I remember, but they were from, Moberly and Huntsville.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely know Moberly. That's just north of where I grew up.
Yeah. Wait, so you're a Missouri native?
Yep. I was born and raised in mid Missouri. So, Moberly's part of mid Missouri, but it's up north a little ways from me. So, I was in Jeff City. And so you'd go 30 minutes to Columbia and then another like 45-ish maybe to Moberly going north.
All right. Well, yeah, maybe we're like distant cousins, you know, who knows?
Dude, it's possible. Here's the crazy thing though. We used to go to Missouri or up to Moberly because, so there's a lot of Amish country up there. And my dad, at one point, this is a random story. He was driving down the highway and there was this Amish guy on the side of the road and his wife had been injured and she needed a way to get to the hospital. It was like a hit and run on her. And my dad actually helped them go to the hospital, gave him a ride and everything. She recovered. And then and this was up in that area. And so then for, you know, my childhood, at least up till I was about 10, we were invited to go to this Amish farm whenever we wanted up near Moberly. And so we'd go there and, you know, live the Amish lifestyle, no electricity, you know, everything made by hand, milking cows, doing all that stuff. It was pretty cool.
Wow. Cool. You know, I have to ask, I'll just start with, you know, from what I've watched a couple of your interviews online and read that op-ed that you wrote not too long ago. And you seem like a nice guy, nice, well-adjusted guy, clear thinker, rational, clear thinker. Why on earth do you want to go into politics?
Dude, we gotta turn this ship around. Like, we are hurting right now. And so for me, it's just, you know, I mentioned growing up in Jeff City, like we didn't grow up in like a nice neighborhood, right? Like nobody really had any money. Now that's not to knock on it. Like this is a magical place when I was a kid, like everybody in and out of each other's houses, everybody's parents helping each other out, kids just running all over the place. And, you know, it's the people around there who helped our family out whenever we had a hard time. And so, you know, I remember my littlest sister was born, had to have a heart surgery, was airlifted to St. Louis a couple hours away. And like, everybody took, I had four siblings or three siblings, there were four of us. Everybody took the other ones of us into their houses when they needed to, when my parents were having a real hard time, like, you know, more lasagna and casserole rolled through that front door than we could ever eat. And that's, you know, these are people without any more money than us. And like when we went bankrupt from those bills, my mom's prayer group, again, people without any more money than us rallied, raised money so, you know, we could get what we needed. And so like for me, I just wanted to spend my life paying that community back. And, you know, it didn't even end there. Like when I got into Yale out of Jeff City High School and didn't have enough money to go, I got scholarships from around town and a Pell Grant so that I could, you know, go live this dream. And I just wanted to always pay that back. So I joined the Marine Corps. Seemed like our state was in good hands. And that would be the best way to serve. I did 13 years, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, arms control negotiations with Russia out of the Pentagon. But it really, after a while, it started to grind on me that I'd go back to that old neighborhood in between deployments and just kind of see what was happening. And like some examples, you know, I go back from Iraq in 2009 to my parents' house, and I go see the first house we lived in, four doors down. It's an empty lot now. You know, I go back after Afghanistan, my parents' house that I joined the Marine Corps out of, vacant and abandoned. The corner stores boarded up. The grocery stores where they used to let my mom, you know, float a check till the end of the month so we could make it are both gone. And the only new houses are Habitat for Humanity houses. You know, so you either got an empty lot or a Habitat house. And it's just like, man, I joined the Marine Corps, thought I was serving everybody there. And it seems like the fight was actually at home.
Well, it's interesting, you know, as a musician, you know, I started touring in the mid 90s and had never really traveled much before, or hadn't traveled at all prior to that. So that was my first time seeing a lot of our country, you know, and I remember being so shocked by the state of these great, formerly great industrial Rust Belt cities and so much of small town America too, that just seemed like empty. You know, it just seemed like they were this sort of rotting husk of like this former glory. Like what do you attribute that to, and how would you approach solving that as a senator?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is corporate consolidation and this search for yield or this search for Wall Street wanting to maximize profit at any cost. And so, you know, what that means for people in Missouri is, you know, when Wall Street or a major corporation seeks efficiency, that efficiency is actually the gutting of our towns. It's the loss of our jobs. It's the loss of American production too. It's not just, it's not like, you know, everybody's like, oh, pity party for the people in the Midwest. It's like, well, we saw during COVID, like we can't make anything in this country anymore, right?
Right, right.
It's because we shipped everything overseas in that search for yield and this corporate consolidation scenario. And so like, we're not the only ones hurting. It's hollowing out our entire country. It's just the place where it's most visible is in places like the Midwest. And so, I mean, like St. Louis was one of the biggest, greatest cities in our country for a very long time. Shoot, even St. Joe in the early 1900s, St. Joseph, Missouri, town most people haven't heard of, was bigger than LA. It's where the Pony Express ran out of, and it was a popping place. But it's just, you know, the more power accumulated on the coasts, the more everything just continued to shift out that way. And, you know, we just got left.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It seems like such an obvious point, but I just don't hear many people sort of acknowledge the severity of this. To me, like the deindustrialization of this country, as well as like the deregulating, you know, all of the financial sector and all the stuff that sort of goes hand in hand with that has created this whole thing, has been, you know, it's been bipartisan. So that's not really an issue to me that's, you know, that conveniently fits into the sort of, oh, it's their fault. It's, you know, our party had nothing to do with it, because obviously as Democrats, I mean, I don't much identify with the modern Democratic Party, to be perfectly frank, although I come from left leaning tradition and worldview. Mm-hmm. But I don't often find, you know, I live in Los Angeles. I don't know that I've ever been in a room full of professional class liberals and heard anybody say like, hey, man, maybe, you know, the policies of the Clinton administration and the Obama administration are a significant factor in creating the conditions that have led to Trump being a viable candidate in 2016 and, you know, all the sort of chaos that we're living through. Why do you think that that is sort of remains a sort of unacknowledged elephant in the room for our side of the aisle?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, politics become this like team sport thing, right? Where no matter what, you're going to root for your team, which is really sad because it's got real effects. I mean, you see this. I remember like my mom rooting for a baseball team that had a guy who just, you know, tried to shoot his girlfriend or something like that. And he's up there and she's going for him. I'm like, Mom, what's up with that? Like, I thought you said you'd never, you know, you're always trash talking other teams for having people like that on the team. She's like, well, you know, it's different because it's my team. It's just like, there is that mentality, which is like sports, you know, maybe whatever. But when it comes to actually people's lives, it's pretty raw. And so I mean, nobody wants to be held accountable. Nobody wants to think that what they did was wrong. Nobody wants to feel like they got tricked either, right? Like, I mean, who did Democrats bail out in the financial crisis?
Yeah, the guys that created the problem.
The guys that created the problem, right? It's simple. Everybody knows the answer to that. And
right.
I mean, I remember being a Marine in stationed at Camp Pendleton, so out in your area in California. I got back from Iraq in 2009. I was stationed in Pendleton, and I remember being in my office and having Marine after Marine come in after we just bailed out the Wall Street banks, saying, hey, I just got back from Iraq, and while I was gone, this bank that we just bailed out foreclosed on my house illegally, violating the Service Member Civil Relief Act, and I don't know what to do because, like, they're not following the law, and, like, you know, something just got mixed up. I could pay. I had a job, and what we saw over and over again was these Marines who had frankly signed up in 2001 after September 11th, when, you know, Wall Street was actually absolutely attacked. I mean, America was attacked, but right, the financial center was the heart of that attack. They signed up, thought our country was together. And before you know it, our country's spending billions of dollars bailing out banks who then foreclose on them. And so, like, I don't even remember where I was going on that. It's just nobody. Yeah, I mean, Democrats didn't bail out the people, right? We bailed out the banks, and it's clear to everyone that's what happened. But, you know, people don't want to own.
I would push back on that a little bit because it's not clear to the people that I live and work around. and I'm talking about like
everybody,
you know,
in Missouri.
But believe you me, it's not clear at cocktail parties in Hollywood.
Wall Street and big tech, right? So Democrats went the way of Wall Street and big tech because they wanted to compete on the dollars. They thought those guys would be okay on the social issues, and so they made this compromise where you know, we're gonna join up with them so we can have as much money as industrial backed Republicans. And it just failed. It failed everybody, but except the elites, I guess.
I mean, for somebody with your point of view, I'm curious, like, what kind of, how you wind up, like, do you have to go to the sort of Democratic Party establishment in Missouri and sort of almost like get approval to run in the primary? It just seems like you're not the type of candidate. Well, you know what I mean? It just seems like, you know, like a candidate that just said what you just said isn't, you know, really in lockstep with the sort of Democratic establishment, you know, of the party, the people leading the party. So how does that work? Like, how do you, because also if you get elected, you have to work with all these people. And I imagine there's a certain amount or a big amount of horse trading that goes on and all that sort of thing. So how do you sort of push from within?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be a super pain in the ass, when I get in there. Here's the thing though. Like, I didn't ask anybody for permission. Frankly, the Missouri Democratic Party wasn't happy to see me run. I mean, I'm a nobody, right? I came out of nowhere. I got these ideas where I think the Democratic Party jacked this whole thing up. Like, used to be the party of working people. We bailed for Wall Street and big tech. And they probably would have been more happy if I just disappeared or, you know, died somewhere along the way. But like, that's the beauty of our country, is that I don't have to rely on them. And our message is like so strong and so clear. That we've been able to raise more money than any Democratic establishment candidate trying to run for a seat like this has before. And so we're getting it all from small dollar donors. I mean, our percentage of $200 and under donations, grassroots donations, was higher than anybody in the entire country last quarter. Anybody, like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, John Fetterman, any of them. And so we get to do our own thing, which is beautiful.
Well, you know, you just touched on something that I think is really important. And that is the Democratic Party over the last, you know, say 40 years or so has completely bailed on working class and middle class voters in favor of Wall Street and Silicon Valley and Lockheed Martin and whatever, you know, elites.
Yeah.
So how do you, what am I trying to say here? Like, how do you reach those voters? Because it's really interesting when you think of who, you know, the sort of, you know, Trump supporters are, that these are the people that were formerly the bedrock of the Democratic Party. And there's been like a seismic shift over the last, basically over my lifetime, that has changed that. So how do you reach those folks and convince them that you're something different? How do you get their support?
Yeah. So
how do you win them back? I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Our message is actually super simple, and that's that we want to fundamentally change who has power in our country. And the thing is, like, people in Missouri are super hungry for that. This has been a populist state where we don't like elites controlling the economy and screwing us for generations. I mean, Harry Truman is like the original populist president. He's actually living in Independence, and you can see his old house out my bathroom window.
Really?
Well, in the winter, in the summer, there's too many trees. But yeah, like this is where that stuff comes from. I mean, Great Plains populace, just everything from out of this area, you know, for generations. And so you can even see that now. Like, we have passed populist ballot measure after populist ballot measure over the last several years. And so, like, you know, this anti-union right to work crap, we fought that back on the ballot, like 68-32%, huge margin pro-union vote. We passed medical marijuana over the state legislature. We passed Medicaid expansion over the state legislature, and we passed a minimum wage that's $5 higher than the federal level, which is crazy, right? Like $12 in Missouri is way more than $15 in, you know, LA or San Francisco or some place like that. So like people here want to have power. We want to live a better life. We want to take it to the people who have been screwing us. It's just, they haven't felt like the Democratic Party is really capable of doing that. Right. Like, and we shouldn't feel like that, but what my campaign is going to do is lead on this issue, show that it works, show that it wins. And get traction that way, and we're going to have people wanting to do the same thing all around the country.
Well, there's a great thing on your website that I was reading that I wanted you to kind of dive into, and it ties right into what you're talking about, and that is the Marshall Plan for the Midwest. What is that? Can you explain that?
Yeah, so it's just investing back in the Midwest, and so I named it after, you know, after World War II, America spent billions of dollars through the Marshall Plan investing in Western Europe to build that area back up. And then when I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, I actually watched us spend $6.4 trillion over there, quote, building up these other countries. And this is another example of these elites lying to us, right? Like, for 20 years, they told us that all this money we were spending, all the lives we were giving overseas was worthwhile, that we were building something lasting, right? And in middle America, we paid that bill, right? We paid it through our taxes. We paid it by sending our sons and daughters overseas. We paid it by putting up with that rather than an investment in our own country for that amount of time. And let's be honest, like, we were facing economic warfare over those years, right? And we still tolerated it. And then we saw, when we left Iraq, ISIS rolled through that place in a hot second. And then when we left Afghanistan, you know, what these people said they've been building for 20 years collapsed in just 2 weeks. And so, like, it's all a bunch of bullshit. And what we want, what, like, people in the middle of America want, is just an investment here in our country. So the Marshall Plan is basically saying, look, we invest in all these other places after war. Well, how about investing in middle America after we've been subjected to economic warfare by the coast for the last 40 or so years?
And what would that look like? Like, what kind of spending programs?
What we need to do, so this goes right along with the way, you know, we've outsourced all of our supply chains. We've outsourced all of our production. You know, we can't make anything from missiles or major end items, you know, for the Department of Defense. I saw this when I was doing procurement at DOD, to the ink in the dollar bill without Chinese input. Like, you can't even make the dollar bill without China. How pathetic is that, man? And so there are all these things that we can just reshore here. We can do it through incentives. We can do it by, you know, building productive capacity. One thing that I really want to do is, you know, worried about greenhouse gases, worried about climate change. This is actually a national security issue. You know, a bunch of our bases will go underwater if sea level rises. For every degree warmer the world, like a place is, there's a much, much greater likelihood of conflict. There's a percentage on that, but I don't remember what it is, so I don't want to be misquoted. But it's a huge national security issue. And so I'm saying, how about we start building batteries here? How about we start building solar panels here, electronic controllers, wind turbines? And, you know, we've been willing to invest in that even in America in the past, but we just get screwed by big companies in Wall Street over and over again. And so when we make these investments that I want to make in the Midwest, they need to come with strings attached. And I'll give you an example of a way of a problem I saw that we need to solve. And that's during the Obama administration, we gave General Electric millions of dollars to build a renewable energy headquarters in Schenectady, New York. Old Union Town that's absolutely been decimated because GE ships literally everything overseas that they can ship overseas. So we invested in that. And then they're supposed to be building this headquarters there, start doing a production there. And then GE realizes that, you know what, they want to purchase Wall Street driven merger and acquisition, which is all Wall Street does. They want to purchase Alstom, France's biggest energy company. And so GE goes over to France and is like, we're going to buy this company. We want to do a merger. And France, who actually decides to, you know, protect its industry and its workers, is like, no, you can't do that. And so GE says, well, what would it take? And they say, well, if you just move that whole headquarters over here, then you can buy it. And so what did they do? They said, screw you, America. Thanks for the money. They moved the headquarters over there. And now they're building all their wind turbines over in France. And they have their headquarters there because they wanted to do a merger. And so and better access to that market. But it's like, but the point of that is that, A, we gave them money without strings attached, right? I mean, if a person gets
not unlike the entirety of the bailout during
right, like every right. bailout, yeah. right? Yeah. And B, you know, B, we didn't protect our workers or our production. And C, the places they're offshoring to, they pay their workers better than we pay our workers. Like, I mean, this is France, for God's sake, right? Like,
right.
France, come on, man. Right. And so
where people get a living wage and benefits. Yeah.
Right. Like we can do this here. It's just a matter of deciding to do it here. And so what I want to do is go into the Senate and decide to do it here. And if we got a close Senate, then I got a shit ton of power, right? Where I can be like, no, we're not doing that unless this goes along with it.
Well, that's, I mean, I love everything you just said, but how do you have an impact there in as far as government policy goes when, you know, the elites that control both parties have designed our economy to work the way it does for their interest, not for the interest of the people, of course, that goes without saying. And they really, yeah. you know, ultimately control both parties in our government. So how do you, you know, do you think that, like, I mean, these are very obvious points that we're talking about. It's certainly not lost on, you know, the leadership of both parties or the people that, you know, to pay them. You know, bankroll their campaign. So, but do you think, like, is the tide turning maybe in a post-COVID world where they're starting to realize, hey, maybe, you know, this is a national security issue and you know, maybe we need to bring some of this back to America. Like, do you sense any of that?
I think that it is. I think that people are starting to realize that our supply chains are crap, that we're wholly reliant on Eastern Asia for pretty much everything. I sure hope they're realizing the semiconductor situation with Taiwan, where, you know, they have essentially monopoly on quality chips. And now the military is in a position where it's like, you know, fight or the economy goes under if China wants to do something about Taiwan. And so there are all these different directions that are pushing towards reshoring. And I think we just need, if you just got like three or four senators, maybe even two, that really just lock onto that issue and say, we're reshoring now, or you're not getting our cooperation on anything else. I think we can make it happen. The thing is that, like, the people of America have now seen it. Like, for a while there, that we weren't feeling the supply chain shortages. It was just all these warning bells people were putting up, but we didn't really feel it. Well, we felt it now, right? Like a bunch of auto plants shut down because they didn't have semiconductors, medical manufacturing shut down. The price of lumber is like through the roof, you know, like everything's totally jacked up. And so
to say nothing of toilet paper,
That's right. I mean, just right. anything. Like we have a moment here. We have a moment probably for the next 3 years where this is in the mind of the American people and we can actually do something about it. And so that's what I'm putting front and center.
I mean, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, and you kind of touched on, you know, your time in the military, but there was some stuff that I saw you talking about. It was like a color coded book of rating. Like, can you get into some of that? Cause it feels like it ties into the whole, it's all part of the same.
It's all part of just the systematic institutional dishonesty.
Right.
The people in charge are peddling on the American people.
And right. And I'm fascinated by like how there's so much finger wagging at people that are, you know, anti-vax or QAnon, all these things that like, I don't believe in any of that stuff. I get it. It's all nuts and ridiculous, but why would anybody trust institutions of power in this world with what you're talking about? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So when I was in Iraq, so I joined the military in 2007. I was just like a little personal history about me. At the time, I was not into the Iraq war, but I did think that Afghanistan was the right thing. I still believe that in 2007 when I signed up, I thought that it was about September 11th. Maybe I was just an idiot. I'm sure other people thought otherwise, but the first place I got sent to was Iraq. And I was like, all right, well, I'll do Iraq and then I'll just sign up for another tour so I can go to Afghanistan. And I go to Iraq and I was supposed to lead a police training team. Around towns, Fallujah, Hamania, Sakhalouia, kind of a messy little area. And so Ramadi and Hamania, that was the area. And so so I get there and they get, you know, I got my 12 Marines, my Navy corpsman, a couple civilians, and we start running missions and we're doing our turnover. And our job is to train the Iraqi police so that they can stand on their own. And so So when I get there, I go for the first week and then they give me this packet of slides, like PowerPoint deck. Everything in the military now is PowerPoint. So it's like 25 slides, something like that. And what it is it's charts that say that basically grade our partner forces, the Iraqi forces, on all the capabilities they're supposed to have. And so it's called a stoplight chart because green means they're good. Yellow means they need work. Red means, you know, oh, shit, we got to really work on this or they're not capable at all. And so I start flipping through it and I'm like, wow, they can do detention operations. They can do like community policing. They can, you know, they can do contact fire, kinetic operations. I'm like, damn, these guys are pretty good. Few things that we need to work on. And then like the only things that were red were like, you know, calling in air support or something, which they'd never be able to do anyway. So it was kind of irrelevant. And so I'm like, oh, maybe this is all right. Maybe we're doing something here. And so then I start working with the Iraqis by myself for a couple of weeks. And I realize, and these guys like can't do any of the stuff that the chart says that they can do. And I have my team, you know, it's not just me making these assessments. My team goes around, does all these assessments and that's the report I get back. So I mean, I email up to hire. I'm like, hey guys, I'd like to do a stand down and just re-rate them on all this stuff because I don't think it's accurate. And we need to reassess and just kind of start over with. And you know, it takes them a little while. They get back to me and they're like, no, we're not doing any reassessments. Everything's good. And when we leave, they actually need to go up in two areas, at least two areas. We're not going backwards. And so I was just like, well, what are we supposed to do if they're not good at this stuff? And I was like, well, just do your best. Right. This is what we've been told from higher. If you send it up, we're just going to send it, you know, we're just going to correct it and send it on. And so there was just this, you know, this is just a good example of just like it really was systematic, like institutional dishonesty, where it's just the entire system was created to show the American people that what we're doing here is worthwhile, to show progress when progress didn't exist and everything else. And so we actually ended up leaving early. That deployment we didn't stay the entire time. So we didn't end up actually ever reassessing them in. We just left the area. I don't know if we like U.S. just pulled out. I don't know if we pulled out because they were good or what. Like a National Guard unit took over after me to kind of do the last deal. But then, you know, a couple years later, we saw ISIS just roll through that entire area. And everybody in America was like, wait a second. Like, I thought we were told that this had been built up, that these people were good to go. And like, how are these Afghan army, these police units just getting absolutely overrun when everybody said they were good to go? And well, there you have it. They were never good to go.
Well, what does that do to soldiers' morale when you sort of realize, have that realization? Because if you were having that realization, I have to assume lots of other soldiers were having that realization too. Like, wait a minute, this whole system is built on a giant lie. This is all BS.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're positive people in the military. And so the idea, I mean, our idea was that, well, if the U.S. just like takes care of everything and all the bad, quote, bad guys, then maybe when we leave, it'll just work out because they're not going to have to do any of this stuff anyway. Right. Well, it didn't turn out to be the case, but that's kind of the thought that you would have. And there's another thought, too, that's like, you know, I signed up. I got sent here. I'm just going to do my best in the situation I'm in. The guy next to me is going to do his best. You know, you protect the guy in the foxhole with you. And the people at the top are supposed to, you just be honest with the people up above you. And then it's their job to make the decision after that. I mean, don't try to get yourself into a bad headspace, because then you're just going to fuck yourself, or excuse me, you're just going to like mess yourself up.
I mean, I'm in hearing your story and all sorts of other stories that I've heard over the years, it strikes me. I'm fascinated by the disconnect between how war is perceived here at home. Mm-hmm. Where it kind of gets boiled down to sloganeering, like, you know, support the troops, or, you know, sort of putting anybody in a uniform on a pedestal and treating, you know, soldiers like superheroes that are like, where if you're critical of U.S. foreign policy, that gets boiled down to you're being critical of individual soldiers, which is obviously nonsense. But that is sort of like, you know, the political discourse around it. But the disconnect between that and sort of the McKinsey management consultant culture of the higher ups in the military.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. These consultants are the worst thing that ever happened to the US government. And these guys will charge. I mean, it's fascinating. Like we used to talk about, like, you know, you were a poor contractor if you only made six figures, and like there were contracts, and this is Iraq and Afghanistan, like contractors wanted to be in the 300 club where you're making $300,000 and a year. And the twisted part about this is that a lot of these contractors were doing the same thing that, you know, like a Lance Corporal who was making $30,000 a year was doing. And so, but the real rub on that is how much McKinsey's charging the US government for these people, or whoever the contractor is. You know, if you go through like the McKinsey tables, and this is the thing, like McKinsey is the contractor with the federal government who decides what contractors should be paid. So they get contracted by the General Services Administration, the GSA, to determine what they should get paid. And so they charge like $900 an hour. It's like $1.2 million. For someone with no experience and just a bachelor's degree, and to come up with bullshit things like stoplight charts that then the generals all want to like conform to and make sure that they perform, because this is a, you know, a satisfying metric. And it just like they're stealing from the American people in order to gut our institutions.
But what does that do to the soldiers' sort of sense of what's what when you're over there and you're not allowed to repair your equipment and they have to fly in somebody because that job has been contracted out to somebody? And so, I mean, isn't this ultimately not only costing us gazillions of dollars, but putting our men and women at risk over there or wherever they are?
It's demoralizing, it's frustrating, and it hurts our readiness. And so, absolutely. So like my friend, Major Ellie Ekman, who's now out of the service, she wrote an article in the New York Times on this, on what you're referring to, which is the right to repair, where all repairs are contracted out. And so she led like logistics and repair battalions, and like her Marines never got to practice on their own equipment, never got to work on their own equipment, because there were warranty clauses and contracts that made all that stuff get shipped back to, you know, Oshkosh, Michigan, or some contractor to come out and fix it. And so there was this big worry that if we ever get in a shooting match and, you know, a shooting war, and these contractors just disappear, nobody's even gonna know how to fix their stuff anymore. And so it really goes back to just the hollowing out of production capabilities and everything else that we've done to our country. And it's really, it all goes back to Wall Street pulling the strings, changing the rules, pushing corporations to do this in a way that, you know, the entire system is very, very frail, whether it's production, repair, capabilities, anything like that.
What now, isn't that connected? Like, I know you've been fairly outspoken about, you know, the events around the pullout of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a lot of coverage about how we just left all this military equipment over there. and basically just gifted it to the Taliban. But I forget, maybe it was,
I don't know if they can use it because they won't have contractors.
Well, doing the right, but, or doing it, but, in but that's what I'm getting at. It's didn't. Yeah. I think I read somewhere that like the contractors had all pulled out by then, so that it was, that was like tied up into why a lot of this stuff got left behind. Or am I remembering that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it got left behind because here's the thing: the people pulling out of Afghanistan didn't want to, they couldn't abandon the systematic lie that what they built there was, it was real and lasting. And so you leave things behind when you believe that it's going to work out the way you think it's going to. And this is like Democrat and Republican. This is everybody, generals who are nonpartisan. Like, you know, they spent, this is goes back to what I said before, they spent 20 years telling the American people that the $2.3 trillion in Afghanistan, the 2,500 lives and everything else was what they were putting to good use and building something lasting. And I believe that. Like I learned Pashto before I went to Afghanistan, the language of Southern Afghanistan, like the language of the Taliban. I went there and I was like, this is what I wanted to do. I was motivated. I felt like I was serving my community back home. And, you know, I still remember like talking to my first Afghans and then just thinking the whole thing was kind of a joke. I remember talking to Afghan national security folks who, you know, were just there because they needed the job and it was just a jobs program for them. I remember talking to Taliban in detention facilities and seeing just like clear-eyed, motivated resolve. And I also remember like every time we left an area when I was there, and I deployed twice, the winter of 2012-13 and then most of 2014. And you know, we've been there for 13 years at that point, right? Like, we should have built something by then. I was still doing all the logistics for our partnered force so that they wouldn't starve and so that they'd have ammo. And every time we left an area, like the US left, the Taliban took over in about 2 weeks. And so people will joke like, I wonder if we leave the whole country if the Taliban will just take over in 2 weeks. Well, holy shit, that's what happened. But it's just like, it's...
It really begs the question.
That was eye-opening for me.
But how could they have been caught with their pants down? How could they have actually believed it? I mean, if it was obvious to you, I mean, why wasn't it obvious to them?
It wasn't just me. Like, the Special Inspector General looked over Afghanistan, did several reports. There was a big one in 2016, I think it was, saying, like, this is just a huge corrupt situation and all the money's going to nothing and Taliban or the Afghans aren't capable of really anything. But they believed because they chose to believe. And because, I mean, you know how it is with a lie. Like, you start telling it enough times, you start believing it, or you really just, you have to buy into it because your reputation's at stake. And so these are the same assholes that we saw on cable news over and over again during the withdrawal, just talking about how, you know, how the withdrawal was all messed up, how the last, you know, 2 weeks was messed up. Well, that's a great narrative for them, right? Because what was really messed up was the 20 years when they were lying to us about what they were building. And they'd love to be able to point at the last 2 weeks that we were there rather than the whole mess and waste.
What a mess. You know, I just to shift gears for a minute, I know that you work with the American Economic Liberties Project with our mutual friend, Matt Stoller.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about antitrust and monopoly power and how that ties into like big agricultural consolidation in the Midwest and like, you know, and how that impacts rural voters in your state.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll give you a good example. And that's there's a company called Smithfield here in Missouri. And now Smithfield does about 25% of America's pork production. And they bought up a whole bunch of concentrated animal feed operations here in the state. And this is where you got big ag consolidation and corruption all rolled into one, which is very emblematic of our economy. And so in 2013, Smithfield wanted to be purchased by a Chinese conglomerate. And Missouri was actually one of the states that was standing between this Chinese conglomerate and Smithfield, because Missouri had a law in the books that said, that basically banned foreign ownership of agricultural land in the state. And so Smithfield, with their monopoly power over pork production in the state, with all the money they'd gotten in their ties to politicians, gave many, many thousands of dollars to both Republicans and Democrats. Like, this goes all the way around the circuit in Missouri, so that they would quietly, behind the scenes, without telling anybody, change the law so that it would allow foreign ownership of land in Missouri, of agricultural land. And so they did that. The governor vetoed it, and then it was the veto was overridden. And suddenly, boom, a week later, the Chinese conglomerate finishes the purchase of Smithfield. And now, you know, a large percentage of Missouri's pork production profits is going to a Chinese conglomerate. And so the other story behind that is what led up to Smithfield being so powerful was the loss of 90% of Missouri's pork producers, like small family hog farms, because they were absolutely decimated by these concentrated feed operations. And you just see people feeling helpless, right? Like they have no power, because if a Chinese conglomerate comes in and can change Missouri law to their benefit, when Missourians aren't able to change the law to their own benefit, like or have any control over themselves, like that's a real sting, right? That's when you feel like you lost power. And so I actually went to the state fair this summer, and I made these bumper stickers that had the Smithfield logo on them and a big stamp across it that said "Made by China since 2013." And so I'm at the state fair, and I go into places like the Swine Barn, where all the small time hog farmers are showing their wares, doing the auctions and stuff. And I just go up to people and say, "Hey, what do you think about Smithfield being owned by China?" And just like, everybody knew about it. Everybody was pissed about it. They were all mad about the monopolies. They were all mad that our state legislature sold them out. And they were thrilled to get my Smithfield "Made by China since 2013 bumper sticker. And several of them even knew me already, which is saying something for a nobody who'd only been running in a race for like 3 months, because of the position that we'd taken on Big Ag. And it's across the whole spectrum. Smithfield's an example, but dairy farms are the same way. If you're trying to run chickens these days, you're essentially forced to be a contractor for Tyson, making less than minimum wage. If you're trying to sell beef, you're pushed, you've seen the price of beef almost double in the grocery store, and the price that farmers get for it has stayed exactly the same. That's because the meatpacking industry, standing between farmers and the grocery store, is taking all those profits. And so it's just everybody in ag's getting squeezed. Our entire state's getting squeezed. But the people at the top are owned by Big Ag. They're owned by the Missouri Farm Bureau, who's owned by Big Ag. And they make decisions that work for them and, strip the normal guy for parts. And so it all just comes back to fundamentally changing who has power in the country. It really does.
Well, it's interesting because that's antitrust enforcement, or the lack of antitrust enforcement, mm-hmm. at least since around the Reagan administration, has been, there's been a gentleman's agreement between the two parties not to really enforce it, not to even bother to enforce the laws that are on the books. So I'm curious, with rural voters in your state, like that's really interesting that they're that engaged in that issue and mm-hmm. aware of sort of what's to blame. But who do they blame for that? And who is to blame?
They blame everybody for that. And so, and they're right to blame everybody for that. So they just blame politicians. They don't blame Democrats. They don't blame Republicans. They blame politicians. They blame the system. They blame the whole thing, that's right. Right. Like they know what they're talking about when they say that. And it's not just Big Ag they're pissed about either. People are pissed about pharmaceutical cartels, who they know are driving up prices to unaffordable levels on purpose. I mean, insulin's a good one. Every time I talk about insulin, people just get fired up because there's three companies taking the price from, $25 to $275 just because they can. And now the price of insulin, it's not a supply and demand market. It's about how many amputations the market will bear from people rationing insulin before there's an uprising. And people know that. They're mad about big tech controlling their lives. This last week has been real powerful on the big tech front. And the real thing about big tech is, they're the big tobacco companies of the 21st century, except you can't even sue them because Section 230 makes it so that they're not liable for content put on their platforms. And so, you go out in the rural areas and they're pissed about that. It's everything. It's the consolidation of our entire economy.
And do you think that's changing? It seems like that's one of the brighter points of the Biden administration. Is it, that they seem to be attempting to push back against monopoly power, with Lena Khan at the FTC now?
Yes, absolutely. Lena's great. So glad she's there.
I mean, do you think that there's, is there a growing sort of consensus with the blob that has to be addressed?
No, there's not, because while we've put people into places, there hasn't been a successful action yet. right? Like there haven't been any results yet. And so, you know, Missouri's the show me state for a reason. Like, you got to show me. And right now, like we're not seeing the results. And so we need real action and we need results before people are going to start believing that that can change. Because right now it's like they've seen both parties, like, you know, maybe occasionally say something out of the side of their mouths about, oh yeah, that situation's all messed up, and then not do anything about it. And so like here, is Lena going to have the power when if Lena does and FTC takes some cases to court, are these corporate judges that both parties have been, you know, appointing for the last 40 years going to actually do something about it? Is Congress going to make it so that the judges have to do something about it by clarifying, you know, the Sherman Act, the you know, any other act that you got on an antitrust level? Like, I don't know. Probably not.
And will that happen soon enough to impact the race that you're running in?
Yeah.
I mean, let's say you get through the primary, and I don't know what, you know, the who you're running against or what the polling suggests or any of that. How do you rate yourself in the general election? As a, you know, do you give yourself a good shot? And or is Missouri so red at this point that it's a hopeless endeavor, or is it, do you think that this is something you could actually win?
When you see the red in Missouri, what you see is anger. Like, we are red because we're mad. We're not red because it's Republican. All right. It's that's the blood in our cheeks. And so again, like, I mean, I described earlier the four ballot measures that people here have passed to try to take power back. Like, people want power back. They're tired of charlatans coming in saying they're going to do something and then not delivering. And so we got plenty of those in our state. On the Republican side, that's who's leading the election. Like, the guy who sold our land to Smithfield, or like made that happen, is, you know, trying to run on an anti-China policy. You should see these guys trying to beat each other up on China stuff, because right. Each day they're more anti-China. And then every other day, a new picture of someone with a Chinese premier pops up. It's madness. And so it's just, you know, we're on the right track. We got the message. We're going to make Missouri a toss up. There's no guarantees with anything, but you know, what we're doing is putting it on the map, and right. The people in the state and around the country are making that happen by investing in a race that, you know, was previously an afterthought and now is on the front of a lot of people's minds.
Well, for people listening, you know, if they like what they hear and want to donate to your campaign, where do they go? What do they do? How do people get involved?
Yeah, go to lucaskuntz.com. So that's Lucas, LUCAS, Kuntz, KUNCE.com. And you can read more about me there. You can read all of our antitrust platform stuff. We're, unlike most candidates, we actually put a lot of the stuff on the website. So we got all sorts of policies, ideas, and things like that on there. We're not hiding anything. And we don't take any corporate PAC money. You know, like I said, all of our money has been grassroots, and it's a beautiful thing. And I'd love it if more people would come out and support. That's the only way we win.
And if you win, what position will I get in your, can you get me in, like, get me a position with the Biden administration, like, you know, Secretary of Kick-Ass Rock and Roll or something? Because otherwise, I'm not throwing my weight behind you, and that could be a real difference maker.
Ooh, I can't believe, you know what? The fact that they don't have Secretary of Kick-Ass Rock and Roll yet is a real tragedy. So we're going to make that
That's
happen
right.
in the running.
That's right. Missouri voters have spoken, pal.
They have.
All right. Well, dude, great talking to you. I really enjoyed it. Is there anything that we didn't cover that, you know, you want to throw out there?
No, it's all good. I mean, it's all about changing who has power. And that's what we're trying to do. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking the time today. I'm sure you got a campaign to run, so I'm going to let you go. But
it's a wild ride.
Go do it. All right, that was Lucas Kuntz, who is running in the Democratic Senate primary out in Missouri. If you want to check out his campaign a little deeper, go to lucaskuntz.com, and I'm going to post some links up on the walkinthefloor.com website so you can check him out if you're so inclined. And we'll be back soon. I think I only have one more interview in the can, and that's with Lee Rocker from the Stray Cats. And after that, who knows what the hell's going to happen? Anyway, this has been Chris Shiflett for Walking the Floor. Over and out. Adios, amigos!